There she had round, rosy cheeks that we all used to love to pinch, saying, "Toot, toot." And so she just became Tootie. She had an apartment in Gibbonsville, North Carolina, and gave me the downstairs couch to sleep on. My nephews had just been babies when I went to prison, and now they were teenagers, and almost as tall as their mother. We razzed each other to the point where Tootie said one day that she now had 3 sons. She was joking, but in a way she was right. I was like a child, completely dependent on everyone else. All those years with bars and razor wire around me, you're no better than a dog in a cage. After being locked up for so long, they just toss you out and expect you to deal with it. I had no money, and how could I explain on job applications where I had been for the last 11 years? My younger brother, Terry, had come up from Fort Bragg to celebrate with us. I was real proud of him. The summer I was arrested, he had finished high school and was working in the mills, delivering yarn to the women working the machines. By the time my trial started, he had gone into the army. Now he was a drill sergeant working on his bachelor's degree. It was as if he saw my life going one way and just went the other direction. As I made my way through the folding chairs and the people on blankets at the park, I felt the stares. So many people in the community had followed the case for years, had read the headlines calling me a menace to society. Some glared at me suspiciously, as if I had just beaten a charge on some kind of technicality. There were others, though, who came up to me and shook my hand. Others who had donated through churches to a fund Tom Lambeth had set up for me. The sky above us lit up and exploded in colors. It was beautiful and frightening to me at the same time. How big and wide open the sky was, blank in the spaces between the fireworks. I was so hungry for life, but at the same time it scared me. Some people come out after being in the system and they're just shell-shocked. They can't get themselves motivated to move forward. They're stuck. Fear just grabbing at them. They just want to depend on others. The first few months I was trapped in that shell, knocking on it, only cracking it, trying to come out. If I went out, I tried to have someone come with me. I was so scared to go anywhere alone. I made sure I had receipts, made sure surveillance cameras at stores got good shots of me coming and going. I always wanted a witness, an alibi for every minute. I often went with Tootie to pick up my mom and take her to cash her Social Security checks. My mother was then living with her boyfriend in an apartment off Shop Road in Burlington. The stroke had left her weak on one side. One leg really bothered her, throwing her off balance. She was also starting to get spacey, like she had a touch of Alzheimer's. I didn't realize when we left court that the way she clutched my arm had more to do with her constant fear of falling. We'd go out walking, and I'd have to say to her, "If you don't relax and loosen up, both of us will go down." A few weeks after my release, Tom and I were invited to appear on the Larry King Live Show out in Los Angeles. They would fly Tom and me out there and put us up. Did I want to go? Without a doubt, I told Tom yes. I had never been to Los Angeles before. Tootie came with me to Greensboro to go shopping for a suit. All of my family had pitched in some cash for it. I was extremely touched. It was still very exciting for me to be wearing civilian instead of prison clothes. But this was my very first suit. It was light gray with a double-breasted jacket. "You look good," Tootie told me when I came out of the dressing room. "But you got to do something about that bushy hair. You look like you've been in a time warp." I laughed at myself in the mirror, looking almost like all the lawyers I had known over the years, except, of course, for the 2-inch afro. On the way home, I convinced Tootie to let me drive. She pulled over on the road that didn't have much traffic, and I got behind the wheel. I put the car into drive and pulled out onto the open road in front of us. But I guess I was pretty rusty. As we rounded a corner, I was too fast with the speed and cut the turn too short and plowed us right into a curb. Tootie screamed as the car hit the curb with a thud and then jumped it. I put the car in the park. Ron, you got to slow down. Let me drive until you practice some more, Tootie said. Come on, Toot, let me drive home. I've got to do it. I've got to figure it out. I'll go slow, I promise, I told her. She looked at me as skeptically as she used to back when we were small. She was a bit of a tomboy growing up. She'd follow me around, and I'd convince her to do things she didn't really want to do. One time, when we had been out in the woods, I had told her, jump across. Just swing on the vine. She had grabbed hold of the Tarzan vine and jumped to swing across the creek, but she only made it about halfway across and fell on her behind right in the muddy creek bed. Just don't mess up my car, she said. She let me drive the rest of the way back to her place, but she braced herself with a hand on the dashboard and closed her eyes every time we got near a turn. Tootie's neighbor was dating a barber who had a chair in Burlington, so I called him up one day to make an appointment. His name was Lonnie, and it turned out we had gone to school together. Elon Elementary and Elon Middle School all the way up to Weston High School before I dropped out. He read a lot about me in the papers, he said. I feel very privileged to be the first one to cut your hair since you come out. You think it'll be a scene? I told him no. I didn't think that my getting a haircut was going to be any kind of news. Some people thought it was strange for me to go back to the community where I'd been convicted. I either got dirty looks or people acted like I was a celebrity. Either way, everyone always seemed to know me. With my new haircut and new suit, I boarded a plane for Los Angeles. Buckling myself in next to Tom, I couldn't help but think of the time I had flown on Express 1 out to Tennessee, and how I never could have imagined this present journey in my wildest dreams. Tom and I talked most of the 6-hour trip. We didn't know much about each other personally before, on account of Tom and Rich's being so busy with my case and all. I learned he had grown up right in Burlington, too. He even owned an ice cream shop. Tom had gone to law school at UNC Chapel Hill, where Rich Rosen had been one of his professors. He's one of my heroes, Tom said. I told him I knew exactly what he meant. He and Rich were both heroes to me. Tom asked me a lot about myself, how I'd come up and how I was doing. To be real honest with you, I need a job, I said to him. I hate feeling like I'm still a burden on my family. I want to get my life started, but I can't without any money. I don't even have a driver's license anymore. I have to take the test all over again. If I can help you find a job, I will. I promise. Let me see what I can do when we get home. Now, I want to share some good news with you. What is it? The governor is going to sign a pardon of innocence. I'm going to announce it on the Larry King Show. What does that mean? It means the highest official in the state of North Carolina is formally recognizing that you were innocent of all charges for which you served time. It's important for the public to know that. People who don't quite understand yet what DNA tests mean. DNA was just beginning to be big news because of the O.J. Simpson trial. At the mall, I had joined people crowding around the TV in Sears the day the verdict came out. When they said, not guilty, everyone had gasped. Part of the Larry King Live show was about making people understand how DNA was being used in trials. I was so nervous being on television that behind the desk in the Larry King show, I had a balled-up paper towel in my swampy hands trying to keep them dry. I tried to stay collected, sitting beside Tom, who wore a black suit with a white shirt. At every commercial break, a girl came over to put more makeup on us. She only put a little bit on my forehead, but she really pounded the makeup on Tom. Larry King told me to call him Larry, not Sir. It throws me, he said, but I noticed Tom also kept calling him sir. I guess he was nervous, too. The assistant district attorney who had been at my exoneration was patched through from Raleigh with Rich Rosen. I could see them on a TV monitor in the background. They talked a lot about DNA, how DNA was even better than eyewitness identification because people can make mistakes. Larry King wanted to know about the two women who made those mistakes. Rob Johnson talked about the fact that there was a total absence of malice. That's what he called it, on the part of the victims. Of course, Larry King asked me the question everybody always wanted to ask. And you're not angry, right? It was hard to put it into words, especially sweating there on live television, that I had had 11 years to think about what had happened to me. Years in prison where I made a decision to let go of the anger and frustration. Since I had gotten out, I went twice a week to Hester Grove Baptist Church and came to feel that God had given me a second chance at life, a chance to really make something of myself, and I could only go forward. Anger would have just kept me stuck, as if I'd never left prison. But I did have a lot of questions I wondered if I'd ever have answers to. I wanted to know why. Why had Jennifer Thompson thought it was me? I could not express it, so all I said to Larry King was, "No, I'm not angry." I listened as Rob spoke about how she was going through a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions. Then Rob pointed out that all three of us had been victims of the same rapist, in a way. At a certain point in the show, Larry King took callers. Some man actually called from Burlington, North Carolina, who said it was just a coincidence he was from there, that he didn't know any of us personally. He had read an article in the paper that talked about the fact that if it had been the 70s, I could have received the death penalty for the crimes and could have been executed before the system figured out the mistake. "Must be scary to think you could have been executed," Larry King said to me. I thought of many of the guys I met at Central Prison once I started working on the kitchen crew, guys who were on death row, no hope left. I don't know how it would have all turned out if I had been in their shoes. I only knew there were more men inside who were innocent, and I wondered if they'd ever get their chance to prove it. Another caller asked if I received training or education in prison, and Larry King wanted to know if I was working. "No, sir," I told him. "Well, what kind of job do you want to do?" "Anything to start out. Doesn't have to be any certain type of job. Just a job," I said. "But is there something special you want to do?" "A job is a job," I said. Soon after we returned to North Carolina, Tom made good on his word. That's the thing about Tom. He's just that kind of guy you can always count on. I called a friend of mine, Dr. James Powell. He's head of Lab Corps. "And let him know what a good kid you are and asked if there might be any openings," Tom told me on the phone. "He's delighted to help. Wants you to call the number I'm about to give you and you can go on in for an interview." At the end of the summer, I started working for Lab Corps in downtown Burlington. The funny thing was that Lab Corps was the same company that had tested my DNA. It wasn't the same office. That had been the Raleigh branch, but still. The job was an important first step in my trying to start my life again. I worked in shipping and receiving, checking in packages drivers came to unload at the loading dock. I'd come down with a clipboard and check to make sure the purchase order numbers lined up. Then I punched them into a computer that would tell me what individual was expecting what package. Then I'd help deliver them in a cart. I got to meet a lot of people working at the company that way. That's how I met Robin. Robin worked in the Cyto Prep Department. I thought she looked a little like that actress, Jada Pinkett. She was a small woman with long, curly, corkscrew hair and glasses, and she acted tough as nails. Turns out we had met years before, although I didn't really recall it. She knew one of my sisters and had come up in the Burlington area herself. When we ran into each other in the break room, she said, "I read the stories about you in the newspaper a long time ago, and I never thought it could be you." She reminded me we had met briefly before. "Whenever I saw you on the street, you were always so polite. You'd smile and say hello. I just knew you couldn't have done what they said." Since my release, magazines and newspapers were always calling me up, asking me questions. The thing I liked about Robin was she never asked me questions. We took to having lunch together, and if I wanted to talk, she would listen. If I did talk about the things that happened, Robin, for all her toughness, would usually end up with waterworks. Since being convicted, even wrongly, of rape, I felt strange around women. I was unsure, after all those years, how to approach them, move forward. I didn't want to do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing that would push someone away. Luckily for me, Robin was very patient, and that's what I needed. "Why are you crying?" I said to her one day as we were getting ready to head back to work. "You remind me of an abused kid I used to know. I can't imagine what it was like to try to tell someone for all those years that you didn't do it and nobody's hearing you. You're innocent and nobody listens to anything that you say," she cried. "Rod, I'm so sorry that you went through that. It's not fair for anybody to go through what you did." I hugged her then, and I realized we were both starting to really care for each other. I was studying the driver's manual again because I had to apply for a new driver's license after all these years and take the road test again. Robin would quiz me sometimes. She also took me out driving in her teal-green Honda Accord, pointing out places that I had forgotten. It was strange to be back at home, but to constantly feel lost while driving around. It made me realize how long I had been gone. When we went up on the interstate, I would get queasy in the passenger seat with all the cars flying by. As cars would approach the passenger side in another lane, I'd jerk, sure they were going to hit us. I was so used to being transported, with bars on the window, when I couldn't see a lot and people couldn't see me. It was even harder to learn to drive on my own, to trust all the freedom that I suddenly had. My father had been in a rest home, and I wasn't sure where it was. One Sunday, Robin picked me up. "I've got a surprise for you," she said when I got in the car. "Oh, yeah? Where are we going?" "We're going to visit your daddy," she said. "Robin, you know where he is? You know how to get there?" It had been years since I had seen my father, although I thought all the time of how important his words had been to me, getting through it all the right way and not giving up hope. "Not really, but we'll find it," she said. After some wrong turns down long country roads, we found my daddy's nursing home in Hillsboro. He had had a stroke some years ago, and now he also had colon cancer. He could no longer walk on his own, and he needed help to go to the bathroom. We found him sitting in his wheelchair by our window. "Dad?" I said. He turned, like he couldn't believe his ears. "Son," he said, "you're home." I knelt down by him and squeezed him hard. My big, tough father seemed to be shrunken down to a bag of bird bones. He was so happy to see me that tears just fell out of his eyes. "I'm so glad you're out," he said. "I told you the good Lord was going to shine his light on the truth, didn't I?" He took Robin's hand as I introduced her. She bent down to kiss him on the cheek. "Nice to meet you, young lady," he said. We spent the rest of the afternoon talking, about nothing and everything. Every once in a while, my father would just stop and look at me as if he couldn't believe his eyes. I told my father I could bring him some things if he wanted, like a radio. "I had a radio, but Nate," he nodded in the direction of his roommate's bed, "that's my roommate. That son of a bitch is crazy. Excuse my language, young lady. He's always stealing my belongings." "There is something I'd really like," he continued, and then tried to sweet-talk Robin into buying him some chips from a vending machine down the hall. "Dad," I said, "you got high blood pressure. You know that stuff's no good for you." He winked at Robin. "Don't you believe him. Ain't nothing that can hurt me now." After that, Robin came with me every Sunday to visit him, and once I got my license, I would try to borrow a car and get out and see him when I could. I loved just driving around, listening to the radio and singing along with it. But even with my own license, I was still having a hard time figuring out where I was going. Once, I drove 25 miles out of my way trying to get to a bowling alley, and eventually I had to pull over and call Robin. "I'm lost," I told her. Tom told me the governor's pardon of innocence made me eligible for a state statute that would give me some compensation for the years I had been wrongfully incarcerated. I remember when Tom had talked about it on Larry King Live, and how Tom had kept trying to explain the amount, and Larry kept getting it wrong. When Tom said $500 per year, Larry thought he said $500 a month. Then Tom said there was a maximum of $5,000, and Larry thought Tom meant I'd get $5,000 a year. Finally, Tom cleared it up for him. For 11 years of my life, I could get $5,000 from the state of North Carolina. Tom and Rich said they were trying to find a legislator to support a new bill to change the money. I guess North Carolina never quite had anyone like me to deal with. I was the first person in the state to be exonerated by DNA. Everybody thought $5,000 was so little, but any amount of money would have helped Robin and me get our lives together. We both worked long hours trying to make ends meet. I had started taking some classes at the Alamance Community College, working toward my GED. I enjoyed meeting people, but it got really hectic trying to study and make enough money. Eventually, I had to make a decision between school and making some money for myself. I took a second job at a restaurant called the Golden Corral. My shift at LabCorp ended at 3 o'clock, and I'd head over to Golden Corral and work until about 10 at night. Golden Corral had a bacon area out in the open, so kids would wander up and watch pizza dough getting tossed. I liked it because you could watch people coming and going. One evening, I was measuring out yeast for the yeast rolls when I noticed Detective Lowe come in to be seated with his wife. When he saw me, he nodded and headed over. He stuck out his hand for me to shake. "I just wanted to tell you I'm sorry about everything," he said. I nodded. "Everyone is Jennifer, too." I wondered if she was really sorry. Why didn't she tell me herself? "We were just doing our jobs, you know." "Yeah," I said, getting back to my job. After saving up enough money, Robin and I decided to move in together. A lot of people thought we were moving fast, but I didn't have time to waste. It felt good to be in love, to be loved again after all that time. We found an apartment on Holly Street in Burlington. For a while, all we really had was a bed to sleep on. Slowly, we began to get other stuff. My mom gave us some living room furniture she didn't want anymore, and then we saved up some money to buy kitchen things. It was the first place I'd ever had on my own. One night, I made her a steak dinner and said, "Let's get married." Robin and I got married on December 21st, 1996, the day I turned 35, in her grandma's house. Pastor Onslow Holt officiated. The following week, we were going to have a big party at a restaurant in downtown Burlington called The Occasion. I showered the morning of the reception, excited to see all my family and friends. Tom Lambeth was coming, too. All the people who had stood by me and celebrate. But when I got out of the shower, I saw Robin sitting on the bed by the phone, looking pale. "Come here a minute," she said, patting the bed next to her. "I need to talk to you." I sat down beside her. "Ron, Tootie just called. Daddy passed," she said. I looked at her with more hurt in my eyes than I knew what to do with. How much more am I going to have to go through, I thought. I couldn't believe after so many years being apart that now my father was dead. I wanted him to see me make something of myself. I wanted to make him proud. Robin held my hand and cried with me. And when I felt like I had no more tears in me, we got ready for our wedding reception. At the party, I felt very happy and very sad at the same time. My mom also sat in her chair most of the night, although when she was younger, she would have been up dancing. I sat down next to her and kissed her cheek. She looked at me. "When the good Lord dials your number, it's time to go," she said. "I know he wasn't always the father you wanted him to be, but he was there in time of need. He was always running around telling people, 'Ron's innocent. I know he is.'" He had no doubt. Not for a minute. He was always proud of you, even while you were incarcerated. Damn proud.
Chapter 15. Jennifer. On a trip to the Outer Banks, I made a deal with the kids. If they behaved, we could stop at McDonald's. The kids were collecting the Batman toys that came with the Happy Meals. Unfortunately for me, my 6-year-olds could only hold out so long, and I pulled off the freeway in Graham, just blocks from the courthouse where my rape trials had been. I was standing in line with the kids and happened to turn around. I found myself looking into the blue eyes of Phil Mosley. Instinctively, I shrank from him. "Hi," he said tentatively. "I don't know if you remember me." "I know who you are, Phil Mosley," I said.
"I just want you to know," he said, "that despite all the trials, I am so sorry for what happened to you back then."
"Thank you," I said tightly, wanting the conversation to end and wishing I could run out of there. I felt so ashamed and guilty.
"You are in my prayers all the time."
I blinked at him, stunned, and then turned back around. I could scarcely breathe because I was fighting tears and I could not start crying in front of my kids. All these years I had thought of Phil Mosley as a hideous bastard. I hated him as I had hated Ronald Cotton. His kindness was simply too much to bear. In 1996, a producer named Ben Loderman phoned me about doing a story for Frontline on PBS. It was going to be a story about how eyewitnesses can make mistakes. My first instinct was, no way. Why would I want to go on national TV and admit that I had picked the wrong guy not once, but twice? I weighed the pros and cons with Mike Galden and Vinny. I had spent so many years protected by law from the public's knowing my name, struggling to keep separate my roles of mother, witness, and victim. While Mike and Vinny both worried about the effects of me reliving it all on camera, in the end, I decided I needed to do it. It was the beginning of a shift in me, a shift that really began when I found myself face to face with Phil Mosley, unable to justify the hatred I had for him. The mistake I made affected so many lives, and I still had so many questions about how it could have happened. Before it happened to me, I didn't think a mistake like this was even possible. And no matter what the science told me, I saw the face of Ronald Cotton in my memories. The producer told me it would help me understand why my memory had done that, why my mind had made it so Bobby Poole, my rapist, became unrecognizable to me 3 years after my assault. I knew it was risky to show my face on TV, but there was no longer any way I could pretend that I had put the rape behind me. Finally, I agreed on the condition that I have no contact with Ronald Cotton, whom they were also asking to participate. During the month or so of filming, the crew would often tell me that Ronald Cotton was a really wonderful guy, that he wasn't angry at all. What Jennifer Saw aired in February 1997, but I couldn't watch the broadcast. I had my husband tape it so I could watch it by myself. I wasn't sure how I'd react, seeing myself describe details of my rape on camera, or seeing Ronald Cotton's face and hearing his voice. The morning after it aired, when I had the house to myself, I put in the tape and watched it with my dog Bingo lying at my feet. At the end of the film, Ronald Cotton told the interviewer that he wondered why he had never heard from me.
"I would like to hear what she has to say, in her own words, to me," he said. When the film finished, the screen went to static. I put it on mute and just sobbed while the black and white blizzard raged on screen. Ron's words reverberated through my head. I would like to hear what she has to say, in her own words, to me. I looked around the den, at the photos of my three children smiling back at me from the walls, and a picture of Vinny and me on our wedding day. 11 years. How do 11 years pass when you are locked up for a crime you didn't commit? I couldn't begin to imagine. For me, they were 11 years measured in birthdays, first days of school, Christmas mornings. Ronald Cotton was exactly the same age as me, and had had none of those things because I'd picked him. He'd lost 11 years of time with his family, 11 years of falling in love, getting married, having kids. He looked forlorn on the television, hurt and bewildered. The guilt suffocated me. I started straightening up the house. I cooked and cleaned and organized so I would stop crying. When I finished the dishes, I wiped my hands on the dish towel and took a deep breath. I picked up the phone. "Captain Galden's office," his secretary answered. "May I speak with Captain Galden, please?" "Who's calling, please?" "Jennifer Thompson Canino." "One moment." As I was being patched through, I curled the phone cord tightly around a finger. I couldn't believe what I was about to do, but my loudly drumming heart marched me forward. After a few minutes, he picked up the phone. "Jennifer, what a nice surprise," he said. "Did you watch the show?" Mike had participated, as well as Phil Mosley. "I did," I said. "How are you?" he asked. "I'm calling to ask you, well, I need to ask you a favor." "I know what you're going to say," he interrupted, catching me off guard. "You do?" "Yeah. You want to meet Ron, don't you?" "Yes," I said, exhaling with relief. "Can you help?"
"Absolutely. Let me make a few calls."
"Thanks, Mike." After watching me suffer so much in the 2 years since Ronald Cotton's release, Vinny knew I had not come to my decision hastily. He supported it, because he thought it might help me.
"You've got to do something," he said. "You can't go on like this."
My sister Janet, however, was completely against the idea. She had already been very concerned about my decision to be public. She thought there was too much information out there about me, and she feared for the kids. "He was no choir boy, you know that. You know he didn't live a right life before. You probably did him a service. He'd have probably wound up in jail anyway." "You don't know that," I said. "We don't really know who he is. I just know that I took him away from his family for so many years. It's not right." "You don't owe him anything, Jennifer. It was a mistake." "Please just try to understand that I have to do this," I said to her. "Well, I know you're just going to do whatever you set your mind to do, but that doesn't mean I have to be happy about it." My parents' reaction was slightly less severe. We had gone for coffee at the Dessertery in Winston-Salem. They still hadn't watched the PBS film, something I hoped they would do because it might give us the chance, after all these years, to talk about it openly. When I told them I had made a decision to go and meet Ronald Cotton, my mother looked down into her coffee. My father patted me on the knee and said, "Well, honey, if that'll make you feel better," before changing the subject. In the parking lot, we hugged goodbye, then we turned to get into our respective cars. My father stopped me as I was getting in and said, "I just want to caution you. Just know that every time you lift the lid off the garbage can, it's gonna stink."
Chapter 16. Ronald. When Tom called me up and said that Jennifer Thompson wanted to meet me, it didn't even take a blink of an eye for me to decide. "For real?" I said. "Yeah, I'd be glad to." But when I told Robin I was going to meet Jennifer, she was furious. "What could she possibly want from you now?" she said. "Robin, I want to do this," I told her. When I had watched the PBS movie and heard Jennifer Thompson said she knew I didn't do it, but that she still saw my face, she might as well have pushed a knife into my heart. It hurt. I needed to ask her why. What was it about me that made her think it was me? If she met me, would she be able to see I wasn't a monster? Everything in Robin just hardened. We argued back and forth on it for a week. She was real protective of me, and I can't blame her for that. She went on with her life, and now you're trying to go on with yours, and what is she trying to do? Mess with it again? It's not fair. You don't owe her anything, Robin said. Why are you so angry about this? I said. Because you're not angry enough, she said. I had had 11 years to deal with everything, but for Robin, all of this was still new. What good is anger going to do me? Why do you always have to make it okay for everybody else? I know you're always telling everyone you're fine. You don't want anyone's pity. Do you know how hard it is to lie by your side night after night and watch you flinch in your sleep yelling, "No, no, no!" she cried. The fighting wore me down. Finally, I said to her, "Robin, I'm going with or without you." The date had been set for April 4th, 1997, and just a few days before, Robin went to speak to her minister and her mother about it. When she returned, she said to me, "It's not fair for me to not want you to go. You're the one who needs to be able to put this stuff to rest, to find peace if you can." And in the end, Robin agreed to come with me. But the whole thing just made her suspicious. We drove over to Tom's office that day so we could all go together. The location of the meeting was kind of hush-hush because no one wanted it to leak to the media. No one knew what was going to happen, and I guess we all had had enough cameras in our faces. Tom explained that the assistant district attorney, Rob Johnson, was a deacon at the First Baptist Church of Elon College, and his pastor suggested we all meet there. The church was set back some from the road. It was all brick with a stained glass window in the front, a picture of a flying dove. Service was over for the day. There were only a few cars there in the parking lot. Galden met Tom and me in the doorway. Instantly, I flashed back to the day I'd walked into the police station and laid eyes on Galden for the first time. Since my release, I had seen him and Lowe around town, and almost every time they apologized to me. "It's good to see you, Ron. How are you doing?" Galden said to me. "I can't really complain. I'm doing well." I stepped inside with Robin and Tom. Waiting just around the corner in the hallway was Jennifer Thompson and her husband, and Rob Johnson, the prosecutor who dismissed all the charges against me. We all stood there for a moment, just looking at one another. In the police department and in the courtroom, there had always been sides. Now, here we were, nothing to separate us. Someone introduced Jennifer Thompson and me, which was kind of funny when you think about it. We had known each other's names for a long time. Even if we had never met again or never saw each other, I would have remembered Jennifer Thompson's name for the rest of my life, just as I'm sure she would have remembered mine. She asked to speak with Robin and me privately, so with her husband, a guy named Vinny, we went into the pastor's study. It was a small, wood-paneled room with a big desk in it and a couch. Everyone else waited in the hallway. I could tell Galden wasn't so sure about leaving Jennifer alone, but she asked him and everyone else to stay out. So Tom and Mike had no choice but to sit out in the hallway. Jennifer had on a long jean dress. Her hair was still blonde and cut shorter than it had been all those years ago. We had both been so much younger then. She looked very nervous. I think it was kind of a shock, our being face to face. We had never actually been that close to each other. Jennifer looked like she wasn't sure what to say or do. She looked down at the ground, then up at Robin, and then at me. She was very emotional already. I could see she was still stuck in all that had happened to her and probably always would be. It reminded me of something Robin said a lot, about the look I sometimes got. "As close as we are, Ron, I can't reach you when you go there," she said to me. "Mr. Cotton, I don't even know what to call you. Ron, Ronald, Mr. Cotton, if I spent the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, it wouldn't come close to how I feel," Jennifer said. "Can you ever forgive me?" Sometimes people don't have to say a thing. If you look directly into their eyes, it's all there. People's eyes talk. I learned to read people like that when I was in prison. So it was good to be there, to hear her and see the expressions on her face. I could see that she was truly sorry. It was plain as day. If she could have gone back and turned the hands of time to change what happened, she would have. "I forgive you," I told her. "I'm not angry at you. I don't want you to spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder thinking I'm out to get you or harm your family. If you look, I'm not going to be there. All I want is for us to go on and have a happy life." Jennifer looked at me, speechless. Her whole face trembled and she got tears in her brown eyes. I could see there was pain, a lot of pain that she was trying to let go. For the first time in so many years, I didn't see the hate in her eyes. She didn't look at me and see the man who had hurt her, the man she wanted dead. She saw me. I didn't even think about it until after the fact, but I reached for her hands and all of a sudden we were standing there hugging. The next thing I knew, Robin, Mrs. Ballbreaker herself, was bawling too. And before I even realized it, tears fell from my eyes. Jennifer asked me questions about life in prison, how I had survived. She also asked me how my life had been since I had gotten out, how I was getting along. "I had to believe God had a plan," I said, "and that this miscarriage of justice would one day be revealed. I used to read the Book of Psalms a lot." "Did you know Bobby Poole?" she asked me. I could see her wince at his name and the memories of what he had done. I met him in prison. I had known some of his family coming up in the area, but I didn't know him. I paused, wishing I could give her more answers. "It's true what Rob Johnson said. We were both his victims." Robin looked at me, and I knew she needed to say something. She kept quiet and let me say what I needed to say. That couldn't have been easy. I nodded that it was okay for her. "Jennifer, I have a lot of anger with you. But this hurt you see being released, you need to see it. Ronald's a good man. There aren't many men that could fill his shoes." Robin then asked if she could talk to Jennifer alone. Jennifer agreed to do it, so her husband and I went into the next room. Mike Golden and Tom jumped up when we left the room. It felt to me like no time had gone by, but I guess to them it felt like hours. "Everything going all right in there?" Tom asked. "Yeah, my wife just wanted to talk to Jennifer alone." Mike Golden and Tom nodded, and Vinnie and I took seats next to them. The four of us guys just shrugged at each other and wondered what the heck Robin and Jennifer could be saying to each other.
Chapter 17. Jennifer. When Robin Cotton asked to speak with me alone, I knew I had to oblige, however uncomfortable it made me. Her anger seemed packed up like a closed jack-in-the-box, ready to spring as soon as there was an opening. For a moment, after Ronald and Vinnie stepped out of the study, I honestly wondered if she was going to slug me. Peering through the blinds of the pastor's study window earlier in the day, I had watched their truck pull into the parking lot. I held Vinny's hand, wondering if I was stupid or brave. In shock, I let go of Vinny's hand when Ronald got out of his truck and walked around to open the door for his wife. As he stood beside Robin, I noticed how tall he was and flashed back to the kinesthetic memory of my body standing in the dark hallway of my apartment the night I was attacked next to the man who threatened to kill me. My rapist had not been that tall. It was the first of many surprises. Robin was another one, of course. I simply had no idea I would be facing not only Ronald, but his wife, too. But I knew it was Robin's right to be there, so I stood there, smoothing my hands on my dress and readying myself for whatever she felt like she had to do. "Jennifer, this mistake you made. If you ever got to know Ron, you would know just how wrong you were. Ron is probably one of the most loving people you will ever meet in your life. I'm still so angry about this. You need to know that now," she said. "Mrs. Cotton, Robin, I am so sorry. I know I was so wrong. I know you went through something awful, but I just don't see how you could think that about him. What took you so long to come forward?" she demanded. "When he first got out, the police advised me not to do anything. They said it was too risky, but I thought about him every day. I remembered what my minister said to me when I went to see him, trying to summon my courage. 'I don't know what I'm doing. How do I do this?' I had asked him. He had told me, 'You will just know. The words will come to you. Ask God, and He will be your words.' But the words coming to me were obscenely inadequate. 'Help me out here, God,' I thought. Fortunately for both of us, Ron knocked on the door then and came in. He looked at me and looked at Robin and gently said to his wife, 'Are you okay?' 'Ron, I don't know if I'll ever be okay with this, because she hurt you so bad, and I can't believe anybody would ever hurt you that bad,' Robin said, crying. Another thing that stunned me, how gentle and soft-spoken Ronald Cotton was. Nothing like the menacing voice I could still hear hissing in my mind, the voice I had associated with his image for so long. And I had certainly never imagined that he would stand before me and say, 'I forgive you,' just that easily and that simply. He was free, I realized, truly free. By the time we made our way outside to the parking lot, twilight was deepening around us. Mike and Tom, wet-eyed themselves, stood off to the side to give us a moment to say goodbye before we went our separate ways. 'It's going to be all right,' Ron said, taking Robin, who was still sobbing, into his arms. Then he reached out, and Vinny and I ended up in his embrace. What a foursome! Sure, he was a very tall man, but it was an inner strength he had that must have allowed him to survive all those years in prison, to wait for the truth to come out. He seemed to be holding us all up. Mike drove us back, and as we passed the familiar streets of Burlington and Elon, the church must have been just a couple of miles from where I had been raped, I felt my anger with the community begin to drain away. Because this small town, where things were greening already and eager to bloom after winter, this town was also Mike Golden, Dexter Lowe, Rob Johnson, and Tom Lambeth, who had gone far beyond their job descriptions as police officers, defense attorneys, and prosecutors to help make something right. We had dropped off the kids with Mike's secretary earlier in the day. They had been told that Mommy had an important meeting, but they didn't really care once they heard they were going to get to hang out in the police station. Morgan, Brittany, and Blake came down to meet us with their arms full of stickers, coloring books, toy badges, and teddy bears. Morgan, always the protective one, said, "Mommy, can we come back again? But next time, don't let Blake eat so many donuts. He got a stomach ache." They did not notice how quiet the adults were when we went out to dinner. Mike accompanied us. We had to be careful about talking around the kids, but we all kept looking at one another, trying to process what had just happened. All I could think was, had I really just been in the arms of the man I had accused of raping me? A few weeks later, Mike called to tell me that Tom Lambeth, Ronald's attorney, was working on getting a bill passed that would increase the amount of money Ronald could get for every year he had spent in prison. Right now, he's only going to get about $5,000, Mike said. I was shocked. Tom had asked for letters of support. Mike had written one, he said. Would I be interested in writing one, too? Of course, I told him. It was the least I could do. Immediately, I sat down at my kitchen table with a yellow legal pad and pen. April 16, 1997. To the attention of Joe Hackney, Dennis Reynolds, and Wayne Goodwin. Dear Sirs, almost 13 years ago, my world was turned upside down by a brutal and violent attack against my body, my soul, and my spirit. I survived and swore that my attacker would be punished and spend the rest of his life in what I hoped would be full of fear and regrets. I did what I thought was the right thing. In cooperation with the authorities, I picked out a man named Ronald Cotton. I testified in a court of law that this was the man who raped me. That's the man, I said. He's the one who raped me. 11 years later, I found out that the face I had grown to fear, the name I had grown to loathe, was the wrong man. I would now begin a new journey, this one filled with fear and regrets, the two things I wished for Mr. Cotton. It is now clear to me that we were and are victims of the same man, Bobby Leon Poole. I ask you to stop, close your eyes, open your hearts, and imagine what it must have been like for Ronald Cotton. An innocent man, looking at spending his entire life behind bars for a crime he did not commit. Days turn into months, months turn into years. Birthdays, holidays, and celebrations are gone forever. He is no longer 22 years old, but 33, and suddenly told, "You are a free man." His world has been turned upside down by a brutal and violent attack against his body, his soul, and his spirit. I know his pain all too well. Can you give him back his years, that life, those moments? No. But we can try to make his new life, his future, and his dreams easier and real. Please consider his requests and others that are in the same situation as Mr. Cotton. He is an extraordinary man with extraordinary potential. As a society, let's not make another mistake. Sincerely, Jennifer Thompson. I don't think, until I stood weak-kneed in front of Ronald, that I had any idea what forgiveness was, nor how powerful it could be. Ronald gave me something that eluded me in the 13 years since that sweltering summer night, the gift of forgiveness, not because I deserved it, but because that's what grace is about. It was the real beginning of my journey back. Forgiveness is tricky. People think when you forgive someone, you excuse what he did. That's not what it is. It's about power and letting go. Forgiveness certainly didn't come to me as easily as it did for Ronald, but I realized Bobby Poole still had a hold on me after all these years, and that the anger that lived in me had completely changed the way I looked at the world, at what was possible. If Ronald had forgiven me so gracefully, so completely, could I forgive the man who had hurt us both? That day we met in church, I asked Ronald if he had forgiven Bobby Poole. "I don't really feel like I have to," he'd said. "I heard he's dying from cancer or something, so if not for the DNA, he would have gone to his death, still not admitting anything. But I'm already past it, and it's not going to do anything for me." For years I had harbored anger, misdirected, of course, anger that kept me caged in fear, judging Ronald, even after his innocence, judging Phil Mosley as less than human. I wanted to be as open in my heart as Ronald had been, to stand before me and forgive me. I needed to forgive Bobby Poole, not for his sake, but for mine. I called Mike Galden up and asked if he thought meeting Bobby Poole was a possibility.
You can certainly request it, but honestly, I don't think your chances are good. People like him are cowards, Jennifer. I'll get you the address to write him, but don't get your hopes up.
Even if Bobby Poole was a coward, I knew that I needed to show him he had not destroyed me that night. It was my way of letting it go, something I never could have done if I hadn't met Ronald Cotton. On the very same yellow pad I used to write a letter in support of Ronald, I wrote a letter to my rapist. April 18, 1997. Dear Mr. Poole, 13 years ago, you broke into my world uninvited and stole from me items more precious than gold. You raped my body, devastated my soul, and shattered my spirit. I have gone through many stages of healing over these years, and this is my final stage. It has come to my attention that you have cancer and your health is not good, so I am writing requesting to see you. For a third of my life, memories, questions, and fear have haunted me. I need to face the person responsible for putting them there. I am not interested in standing in judgment of you, because that day is coming very quickly for you, and it is not for me to do. However, I do want to look into your eyes so I can put to rest the many questions I have had for so long. I faced you with courage and bravery on that July night. You never asked my permission. Now I ask you to face me, but I am asking for yours. Please reply as soon as possible. Sincerely, Jennifer Thompson. As Mike predicted, my letter to Bobby Poole went unanswered. But something else surprising happened. Ronald Cotton and I began to talk. At first, we talked because we were dealing with interview requests. I always called Ronald to see if he might be able to come, too. We were friendly with each other, exchanging small talk initially. But while reporters would check their notes and photographers would set up, we found time to learn about each other's lives, and soon we were talking on the phone just to keep each other updated on our lives. Ron was funny and smart. Once I had to bring the kids with me, and I decided it was time they met Ron anyway. As we drove to the church in Elon, I explained to them that Ronald had spent time in prison because I had thought he'd done a bad thing, but that I had been wrong. The kids were absolutely fascinated with him. "What was prison like?" Blake, the bravest, asked.
"Well, it was tough. The food wasn't very good, for one," Ron said. "But sometimes we found ways to have things that reminded us of home."